Hello, lads. This is Fake Sean Connery, and I have some bad news, and some good. The bad news is you've stumbled upon the podcast that dares not speak its name. The good news is it's not too late to turn it off.
Good morning, folks. That's right, morning. More times than not, I record these episodes at night or coming back from the cabin, well, which is usually right before it gets dark. But for some reason, I forgot to take my recorder to the cabin yesterday, and I was forced to record a story on my laptop. It has a microphone, and I'm fairly sure that the sound will be fine. It's probably not going to be the same quality, but it's fine. And so I was going to record the episode around the story on my way back yesterday, and I didn't have the recorder, and I've got a new cell phone which doesn't have a voice recorder function on it. I think you have to download it as an app, which maybe I should do right now instead of this, so that I don't have that problem again. I had an appointment this morning, and it fell through, but I was already there. And so I thought, well, okay, now what do I do other than be angry? And the answer was, do that episode that I was supposed to do last night. So I'll have Fake Sean Connery tell you that this is an episode of the podcast that dares not speak its name. I'm Rish Outfield, and today I'm going to share a story by Ray Bradbury. I've done him before. I think this will probably be the third Bradbury story that I've done on here. But for the life of me, I can only remember doing The Foghorn. Huh. Bradbury was probably the most famous of the writers in the golden age of science fiction. And a list of his published short stories wouldn't fit on a single page. It's so impressive. If you look at just the number of short story collections that he put out, the man was amazingly prolific, and I wish that I could be a little bit more like him. This year, 2023, has been not my least productive year, but it's up there. There have been weeks when I haven't gone to the library to write. I haven't set a lot of writing goals, and so maybe that needs to change. But by the time this comes out, 2023 is going to be close to over. And so I'll do my best to do better in 2024. The thing with Bradbury is I never met the man, and that's one of my regrets, because I could have. But he was always getting ideas for stories. And he would say, there's not a single day when I don't go somewhere and see something or hear somebody say something that gives me an idea for a story. And if you think about that he lived to be in his 90s, that is a ton of ideas. And maybe everybody is like that. But I've noticed, at least in this year, that there have been multiple days when I don't get an idea for a story. I don't have some inspiration strike. And I know that creativity, that writing is a muscle, and you need to exercise that muscle. I know that. And so my muscle may be atrophied a little bit. I need to get back on the treadmill or the exercise bike. What is that thing that was really, really popular around the pandemic? It was like a virtual Peloton. That. I need to, anyway. Something that I found in 2020 and 2021 was that when I would go running, my imagination, it would kick into a higher gear. I started thinking about writing, thinking about stories, thinking about the project that I was currently working on, so that when I got home, I wanted to write, I wanted to work on it, I wanted to get those ideas down, because if I didn't, they'd be gone. And I have been exercising, but I haven't been listening to music when I run. And maybe I need to go back to that, because I found that if I'm listening to a podcast or a YouTube video, I'm focused on that rather than just where my brain might take me. Okay, I am going to present this story called
Night Call Collect.
From his collection, I Sing the Body Electric. And I'll tell you why I picked this story after I run it.
Ray Bradbury is dead.
Night Call Collect by Ray Bradbury. Narrated by Rish Outfield. What made the old poem run in his mind, he could not guess. But run, it did. Suppose, and then suppose, and then suppose, that wires on the far-slung telephone black poles sopped up the billion-flooded words they heard each night, all night, and saved the sense and meaning of it all. He stopped. What next? Ah, yes. Then jigsaw in the night, put all together and, in philosophic phase, tried words like moron child. Again he paused. How did the thing end? Wait. Thus mindless beast, all treasuring of vowels and consonants, saves up a miracle of bad advice and lets it filter, whisper, heartbeat out, one lisping murmur at a time. So one night soon, someone sits up, hears sharp bell ring, lifts phone, and hears a voice like Holy Ghost, gone far in nebulae. That beast upon the wire, which with sibilance and savorings, down continental madnesses of time, says hell and oh, and then hello. He took a breath and finished. To such creation, such dumb brute, lost electric beast, what is your wise reply? He sat silently. He sat, a man 80 years old. He sat in an empty room, in an empty house, on an empty street, in an empty town, on the empty planet Mars. He sat, as he had sat now for 50 years, waiting. On the table in front of him lay a telephone that had not rung for a long, long time. It trembled now with some secret preparation. Perhaps that trembling had summoned forth the poem. His nostrils twitched. His eyes flared wide. The phone shivered, ever so softly. He leaned forward, staring at it. The phone rang. He leapt up and back. The chair fell to the floor. He cried out,
no!
The phone rang again.
No!
He wanted to reach out. He did reach out and knocked the thing off the table. It fell out of the cradle at the exact moment of its third ring.
No! Oh, no!
He said softly, hands covering his chest, head wagging, the telephone at his feet.
It can't be. Can't be.
For after all, he was alone in a room in an empty house in an empty town on the planet Mars, where no one was alive. Only he lived. He was king of the barren hill. And yet...
Barton!
Someone called his name. No, Some thing buzzed and made a noise of crickets and cicadas in far desert lands.
Barton?
He thought.
Why, that's me.
He hadn't heard anyone say his name in so long, he had quite forgot. He was not one for ambling about, calling himself by name. He had never.
Barton,
said the phone.
Barton, shut up,
he cried, and kicked the receiver and bent, sweating, panting, to put the phone back on its cradle. No sooner did he do this than the damned thing rang again. This time, he made a fist around it, squeezed it as if to throttle the sound. But at last, seeing his knuckles burn color away to whiteness, let go and picked up the receiver.
Barton,
said a far voice, a billion miles away. He waited until his heart had beat another 3 times and then said,
Barton, here?
Well, said the voice, only 1,000,000 miles away now. Do you know who this is?
Christ, said the old man. The first call I've had in half a lifetime, and we play games.
Sorry. How stupid of me. Of course you wouldn't recognize your own voice on the telephone. No one ever does. We are accustomed, all of us, to hearing our voice conducted through the bones of our head. Barton, this is Barton.
What?
Who did you think it was? Said the voice. A rocket captain. Did you think someone had come to rescue you?
No.
What's the date?
July 2097.
Good Lord. 50 years? Have you been sitting there that long, waiting for a rocket to come from Earth? The old man nodded. Now, old man, do you know who I am?
Yes, he trembled. I remember. We're one. I am Emil Barton, and you are Emil Barton.
With one difference. You're 80. I'm only 20. All of life before me. The old man began to laugh, and then to cry. He sat, holding the phone like a lost and silly child in his fingers. The conversation was impossible and should not be continued. Yet he went on with it. When he got hold of himself and held the phone close and said,
You there, listen, oh God, if I could warn you. How can I? You're only a voice. If I could show you how lonely the years are. End it. Kill yourself. Don't wait. If you knew what it is to change from the thing you are to the thing that is me today, here, now, at this, and...
Impossible! The voice of the young Barton laughed, far away. I've no way to tell if you ever got this call. This is all mechanical. You're talking to a transcription, no more. This is 2037, 60 years in your past. Today, the Atom War started on Earth. All colonials were called home from Mars. By rocket. I got left behind.
I remember, whispered the old man.
Alone on Mars, laughed the young voice. A month, a year, who cares? There are foods and books. In my spare time, I've made transcription libraries of 10,000 words, responses, my voice, connected to phone relays. In later months, I'll call. Have someone to talk with.
Yes.
60 years from now, my own tapes will ring me up. I don't really think I'll be here on Mars that long. It's just a beautifully ironic idea of mine. Something to pass the time. Is that really you, Barton? Is that really me? Tears fell from the old man's eyes.
Yes.
I've made 1,000 Bartons, tapes, sensitive to all questions, in 1,000 Martian towns. An army of Bartons over Mars while I wait for the rockets to return.
Fool.
The old man shook his head wearily.
You waited 60 years. You grew old waiting, always alone. And now you've become me, and you're still alone in the empty cities. Hey, don't expect my sympathy. You're like a stranger, off in another country. I can't be sad. I'm alive when I make these tapes, and you're alive when you hear them. Both of us, to the other, incomprehensible. Neither can warn the other, even though both respond, one to the other, one automatically, the other warmly and humanly. I'm human now. You're human later. It's insane. I can't cry because not knowing the future, I can only be optimistic. These hidden tapes can only react to a certain number of stimuli from you. Can you ask a dead man to weep?
Stop it! Cried the old man. He felt the familiar seizures of pain. Nausea moved through him, and blackness.
Oh, God, but you are heartless. Go away.
Were, old man? I am. As long as the tapes glide on, as long as the spindles and hidden electronic eyes read and select and convert words to send to you, I'll be young and cruel. I'll go on being young and cruel long after you're dead. Goodbye.
Wait, cried the old man.
Click. Barton sat holding the silent phone a long time. His heart gave him intense pain. What insanity it had been. In his youth, how silly, how inspired. Those first secluded years. Fixing the telephonic brains, the tapes, the circuits, scheduling calls on time relays. The phone bell.
Morning, Barton. This is Barton. 7 o'clock. Rise and shine.
Again.
Barton. Barton calling. You're to go to Marstown at noon. Install a telephonic brain. Thought I'd remind you.
Thanks. The bell.
Barton. Have lunch with me. The Rocket Inn.
Right.
See ya. So long. Ring. That you be? Thought I'd cheer you. Firm chin and all that. The rescue rocket might come tomorrow to save us.
Yes.
Tomorrow. Tomorrow. Tomorrow.
Click. But the years had burned into smoke. Barton had muted the insidious phones and their clever, clever repartee. They were to call him only after he was 80, if he still lived. And now today, the phone ringing, the past breathing in his ear, whispering, remembering. The phone. He let it ring.
I don't have to answer it, he thought.
The bell.
There's no one there at all,
he thought. The ringing.
It's like talking to yourself, he thought. But different. Oh, God, how different.
He felt his hands lift the phone.
Hello, old Barton. This is young Barton. I'm 21 today. In the last year, I've put voice brains in 200 more towns. I've populated Mars with Bartons.
Yes.
The old man remembered those nights 6 decades ago, rushing over blue hills and into iron valleys with a truck full of machinery, whistling, happy. Another telephone, another relay. Something to do, something clever and wonderful and sad. Hidden voices, hidden, hidden. In those young days when death was not death, time was not time, old age a faint echo from the long cavern of years ahead. That young idiot, that sadistic fool, never thinking someday he might reap this harvest.
Last night, said Barton, aged 21, I sat alone in a movie theater in an empty town. I played an old Laurel and Hardy. God, how I laughed.
Yes.
I got an idea. I recorded my voice 1,000 times on one tape. Broadcast from the town, it sounds like 1,000 people. A comforting noise, the noise of a crowd. I fixed it so doors slam in town, children sing, music boxes play, all by clockworks. And if I don't look out the window, if I just listen, it's all right. But if I look, it spoils the illusion. I guess I'm getting lonely.
The old man said.
That was your first sign,
What?
The first time you admitted you were lonely.
I've experimented with smells. As I walk the empty streets, the smell of bacon, eggs, ham, fillets come from the houses, all done with hidden machines.
Madness.
Self-protection.
I'm tired.
Abruptly, the old man hung up. It was too much. The past drowning him.
Swaying, he moved down the tower stairs to the streets of the town. The town was dark. No longer did red neons burn, music play, or cooking smells linger. Long ago, he had abandoned the fantasy of the mechanical lie. Listen, are those footsteps? Smell, isn't that strawberry pie?
He had stopped it all. He moved to the canal where the stars shone in the quivering waters. Underwater, in row after fish-like row, rusting, were the robot population of Mars he had constructed over the years and, in a wild realization of his own insane inadequacy, had commanded to march 1, 2, 3, 4 into the canal depths, plunging, bubbling like sunken bottles. He had killed them and shown no remorse. Faintly, a phone rang in a lightless cottage. He walked on. The phone ceased. Another cottage ahead rang its bell as if it knew of his passing. He began to run. The ringing stayed behind, only to be taken up by a ringing from now this house, now that, now here, there. He darted on. Another phone.
All right!
He shrieked, exhausted.
I'm coming!
Hello, Barton.
What do you want?
I'm lonely. I only live when I speak. So I must speak. You can't shut me up forever.
Leave me alone,
said the old man in horror.
Oh, my heart.
This is Barton, age 24. Another couple of years gone. Waiting. A little lonelier. I've read War and Peace, drunk sherry, run restaurants with myself as waiter, cook, entertainer. Tonight, I star in a film at the Tivoli. Emile Barton in Love's Labor Lost, playing all the parts. Some with wigs.
Stop calling me, or I'll kill you.
You can't kill me. You'll have to find me first.
I'll find you.
You've forgotten where you hid me. I'm everywhere. In boxes, houses, cables, towers, underground. Oh, go ahead. Try. What do you call it? Telecide? Suicide? Jealous, are you? Jealous of me here? Only 24, bright-eyed, strong, young. All right, old man. It's war. Between us. Between me. A whole regiment of us. All ages against you. The real one. Go ahead. Declare war.
I'll kill you.
Click. Silence. He threw the phone out the window.
In the midnight cold, the automobile moved in deep valleys. Under Barton's feet on the floorboard were revolvers, rifles, dynamite. The roar of the car was in his thin, tired bones.
I'll find them, he thought, and destroy all of them. Oh God, how can he do this to me?
He stopped the car. A strange town lay under the late moons. There was no wind. He held the rifle in his cold hands. He peered at the poles, the towers, the boxes. Where was this town's voice hidden? That tower? Or that one there? So many years ago. He turned his head now this way, now that way, wildly. He raised the rifle. The tower fell with the first bullet.
All of them, he thought. All of the towers in this town will have to be cut apart. I've forgotten. Too long.
The car moved along the silent street. A phone rang. He looked at the deserted drugstore. A phone. Pistol in hand, he shot the lock off the door and entered. Click. Hello, Barton. Just a warning. Don't try to rip down all the towers, blow things up. Cut your own throat that way? Think it over.
Click. He stepped out of the booth slowly and moved into the street and listened to the telephone towers humming high in the air. Still alive. Still untouched. He looked at them. And then he understood. He could not destroy all the towers. Suppose a rocket came from Earth. Impossible idea, but suppose it came tonight, tomorrow, next week, and landed on the other side of the planet, and used the phones to try to call Barton, only to find the circuits dead. Barton dropped his gun.
A rocket won't come,
he argued, softly with himself.
I'm old. It's too late.
But suppose it came. And you never knew, he thought. No, you've got to keep the lines open. Again, a phone ringing. He turned dully. He shuffled back into the drugstore and fumbled with the receiver.
Hello? A strange voice.
Please, said the old man, don't bother me.
Who's this? Who's there? Who is it? Where are you? Cried the voice, surprised.
Wait a minute.
The old man staggered.
This is Emil Barton. Who's that?
This is Captain Rockwell, Apollo Rocket 48, just arrived from Earth.
No.
Are you there, Mr. Barton?
No, it can't be.
Where are you?
You're lying.
The old man had to lean against the booth. His eyes were cold blind.
It's you, Barton, making fun of me. Lying again.
This is Captain Rockwell. Just landed. In New Chicago. Where are you?
In Green Villa, he gasped. That's 600 miles from you.
Look, Barton, can you come here?
What?
We've repairs on our rocket. Exhausted from the flight. Can you come help?
Yes.
We're at the field outside town. Can you come by tomorrow?
Yes, but...
Well?
The old man petted the phone.
How's Earth? How's New York? Is the war over? Who's president now? What happened?
Plenty of time for gossip when you arrive.
Is everything fine?
Fine.
Thank God.
The old man listened to the far voice.
Are you sure you're Captain Rockwell?
Damn it, man.
I'm sorry.
He hung up and ran.
They were here. After many years, unbelievable, his own people who would take him back to Earth's seas and skies and mountains. He started the car. He would drive all night. It would be worth a risk to see people, to shake hands, to hear them again. The car thundered in the hills. That voice, Captain Rockwell. It couldn't be himself, 40 years ago. He had never made a recording like that. Or had he? In one of his depressive fits, in a spell of drunken cynicism, hadn't he once made a false tape of a false landing on Mars with a synthetic captain? An imaginary crew? He jerked his head savagely. No. He was a suspicious fool. Now was no time to doubt. He must run with the moons of Mars all night. What a party they would have. The sun rose. He was immensely tired, full of thorns and brambles, his heart plunging, his fingers fumbling the wheel. But the thing that pleased him most was the thought of one last phone call.
Hello, young Barton. This is old Barton. I'm leaving for Earth today. Rescued.
He smiled weakly. He drove into the shadowy limits of New Chicago at sundown. Stepping from his car, he stood staring at the rocket tarmac, rubbing his reddened eyes. The rocket field was empty. No one ran to meet him. No one shook his hand, shouted, or laughed. He felt his heart roar. He knew blackness and a sensation of falling through the open sky. He stumbled toward an office. Inside, 6 phones sat in a neat row. He waited, gasping. Finally, the bell. He lifted the heavy receiver. A voice said, "I was wondering if you'd get there alive." The old man did not speak, but stood with the phone in his hands. The voice continued, "Captain Rockwell, reporting for duty.
Your orders, sir?"
"You?" groaned the old man. "How's your heart, old man?"
"No.
Had to eliminate you some way, so I could live, if you call a transcription living."
"I'm going out now," replied the old man. "I don't care. I'll blow up everything until you're dead."
"You haven't the strength. Why do you think I had you travel so far, so fast? This is your last trip." The old man felt his heart falter. He would never make the other towns. The war was lost. He slid into a chair and made low, mournful noises with his mouth. He glared at the 5 other phones. As if at a signal, they burst into chorus. A nest of ugly birds screaming. Automatic receivers popped up. The office whirled. "Barton! Barton! Barton!" He throttled a phone in his hands. He choked it, and still it laughed at him. He beat it. He kicked it. He furled the hot wire like serpentine in his fingers, ripped it. It fell about his stumbling feet. He destroyed 3 other phones. There was a sudden silence. And, as if his body now discovered a thing which it had long kept secret, it seemed to sink upon his tired bones. The flesh of his eyelids fell away like petals. His mouth withered. The lobes of his ears were melting wax. He pushed his chest with his hands and fell face down. He lay still. His breathing stopped. His heart stopped. After a long spell, the remaining 2 phones rang. A relay snapped somewhere. The 2 phones were connected, one to the other. "Hello? Barton?"
"Yes, Barton."
"Age 24.
"I'm 26.
"We're both young. What's happened?" "I don't know. Listen." The silent room. The old man did not stir on the floor. The wind blew in the broken window. The air was cool.
"Congratulate me, Barton. This is my 26th birthday."
"Congratulations." The voices sang together. About birthdays, and the singing blew out the windows, faintly, faintly, into the dead city.
All right, and we're back. Now, chances are, if you know me, you know why I picked that story. But before yesterday, I had never read that story. I picked up a collection of Bradbury stories and thought that I would read a few of them, because his stuff is always very idea-centric. You know what I mean? It's not all about character. It's not all about some kind of message that he's trying to impart. It's all about an idea that jumped into his head that he thought would be interesting. And you know, there's different ways to write fiction. And, you know, with me, I've had stories that are very character-based and stories that are very concept-based. But when I saw that there was a story where a man got a call from himself, I thought, okay, well, that's the one I'm going to read today. The interesting twist is that this is an old man getting calls from his younger self. But is it really? I mean, I didn't entirely understand what was happening with these
with these calls. There's the one part where the young version explains that he doesn't really hear him. I think it's just a program that has the younger version's voice, but it may also be that the younger version made 1,000 phone calls or 10,000 phone calls, and they're all programmed for certain responses depending on what the old version says. I still don't understand how it works. But you don't have to understand it. There's something really unique and special about the way that Bradbury wrote. And, you know, it's all set on Mars, and yet it's set in the future. Because usually it's like, you know, when we first colonized Venus back in 1968, you know, that kind of stuff. You're just like, what? But this one is still way off in the future. I won't live to see the year that this story takes place. In fact, if we think about it, about him being 80 years old, you can predict exactly what generation. I mean, maybe this is a Gen Z guy, huh? Anyhow, I find these stories to be very lean. There's not a lot of flab on these stories, and I wonder if it's because Ray was sending them out as fast as he could write them, and he didn't have time to puff them up. He didn't have time to go off on tangents. It's just, that's what this story is about. I'll see if I can get it done by this time tomorrow, and then, you know, on Wednesday I'll send it out. I'm not sure how his writing worked. I'm the furthest thing from an expert on Ray Bradbury. I had never read a single story that's in this collection. And I only know I Dream the Body Electric because there was a Twilight Zone episode adapted from it. Not every story is going to be great. Although, my guess is that most of these stories are good enough that a magazine bought them. And of course, good and bad are relative. You know, somebody who loves Ray Bradbury and comes to this podcast and hears this production might say, well, why doesn't Rish do a Bradbury story all the time? It's like, you know, he reveres Stephen King, who is just a huge hack. And yet Bradbury, he'll go 2-3 years in between Bradbury stories or longer, because I could be wrong, and I've only ever done that one, the one about the lighthouse. There are many, many more stories in the book. It's probably got 20 stories in it. Maybe I can go through and read some of them. At this point, I was going to read I Sing the Body Electric last night, but life gets in the way. There's just... I go to the cabin, and I feel like, okay, this is my time. This is my weekend. I can do whatever I want. Yet there are things that I'm supposed to do. Yet I try and edit. Yesterday, I tried to write a little bit because I've fallen so far behind. And I should have said this at the very beginning of the episode. I like doing the podcast that dares not speak its name more than the Rish Outcast. And maybe you can guess why. It's because it's easier. I take somebody else's story, then I give my thoughts on it. And if it's a story of my own, I have to have come up with the idea for the story, I have to have written the story and actually finished it, which is still way too rare. And then usually I will have to do a polish. I record the story, which takes forever because I find all sorts of things I want to fix. Then I have to edit that story, and then I can talk about it. Whereas the first like 5 steps are absent on a podcast that dares not speak its name. I
think I set a goal for doing 10 of them in 2023. But I think I probably could have done 15 of them or 20 of them if I had worked really hard. They're long and they still are work, but there's an infinite number of stories out there written by other people. And the stories written by Rish Outfield are very finite. Plus, there's always the fear that somebody's going to say, oh, I didn't like this story, or oh, you're a hack, just like Stephen King, that will, you know, break my heart, that will hurt my confidence, that will make me not want to write for a good while after that. And you guys wouldn't do that, I understand. But there's always that risk. And sometimes that person that says you're a hack, just like Stephen King, is me. I've recorded stories for the podcast and then decided that's not good. I don't think I'll run that on the podcast. There's no such risk with somebody else's story. Somebody could say, oh, I didn't like that story at all. But that's on, you know, Edith Nesbitt. That's not on me. Sometimes I don't have anything interesting to say about the story. And that's a risk there, but it's not a huge one. There are multiple recordings on my laptop of stories that I did when I was at the cabin that I'm never going to do on the show. Because I get to the end and I go, huh, well, that didn't really do anything for me. But if there was a dollar sign attached to it, I could put that story out and then talk about something else afterward, or force myself to talk about, well, what was it I didn't like about the story? What would I have done differently, you know? Anyhow, I liked this story. I found that it was sad and obviously cruel in its ending. And the young self doing what he could to give the old man a heart attack. What the hell, dude? I mean, what? I don't get that. It's just really, really cruel and dark and mean. And maybe it's something that Big Anklevich could understand for one of his stories. But I just... It could also have just been a twist that Bradbury thought up. It's like, no, there were no rescuers that came. It's just a mean trick, and it causes the guy to have a heart attack and die. That's pretty dark.
Well, this is sort of a tangent. Sort of not. I don't feel like I spoke enough about the story, but that ending. There is a sense of playing it safe in entertainment intended for the masses. Hollywood movies would be blockbusters. They tend to be predictable, especially in their endings. You wouldn't want a portion of the audience to be disappointed. You wouldn't want a movie to be something that, you know, parents don't want to take their kids to. You wouldn't want casual moviegoers to walk out of the theater thinking, dang, or huh. But that can be really restrictive. You want the audience to not trust you 100%. That our heroes will get out of this, that there will be a happy ending. You want to put that seed of doubt in their mind. And one of the ways that you do it is by having the occasional unhappy ending. The idea that our hero might not make it out okay, or that our team won't emerge unscathed, that's something that too often writers and filmmakers shy away from, but it's a power. The unhappy ending, it's like something that you have in your back pocket. I guess I'll invoke that hack Stephen King again. You know, there are a couple of his stories that just have really wallopingly hard, cruel endings. Where the bad guys win, where the hero despairs or loses, or where all is lost. And you can do that too much. I think Big Anklevich regrets having set that precedent with his work, that it's going to have a downer ending. But there is a power in that. Big also has the opportunity to turn that on its ear. You know, he has earned that dread in his audience of, oh my gosh, he wouldn't. Maybe he would. And yeah, if you've listened to his podcast or read a lot of his stories, at this point you're just like, oh shoot, no, he totally would. And so when he pulls up on the, what do you call that thing that flies the plane?
I don't know.
Let's just say the steering wheel. And the plane lands safely. The relief is all the more palpable. I guess I'll invoke that hack, Stephen King, again. The reason I keep using that term is somebody on YouTube, after I put out the Weeds episode, that was their only comment. But a couple of his stories have just, you know, slap in the face endings. And some of his novels do too, which is ballsy. But of course he's a horror writer. And if your audience doesn't believe that the family's not going to make it, that the hero could fail, that he'd actually kill a child, then they're not invested 100%. They're not so full of fear and dread. You know, what if Jack Torrance kills his family? The previous caretaker certainly did. You know, the ending of Pet Sematary, and particularly the ending of Cujo, I think about, because, you know, he kills the child in Pet Sematary, kills the old man, kills the wife. You know, it's like, how far will this guy go? And then in Cujo, when I got to the ending and it ended the way it did, I was just like, oh my gosh, why did I read this? And maybe that means it's too much. When, was it Lewis Teague made the adaptation of Cujo into a movie in the 80s, they decided to change the ending because I think they were afraid moviegoers, even though it's a horror movie, would not accept that ending. And I get that. You've got the temptation always to have them leave the theater feeling good, that good has triumphed over evil. But, you know, a filmmaker like David Fincher, a lot of his reputation was built on the fact that, no, you know, he's going to kill Ellen Ripley. He's going to kill Gwyneth Paltrow. He's going to allow the villain to win. He's going to have an absolutely absurd, stupid Aaron Kruger ending for Michael Douglas and Sean Penn. You know, I was a teenager when Thelma and Louise came out. That's a Ridley Scott movie, not a David Fincher movie, but the ending was all anybody could talk about. I knew how that movie ended before I knew almost anything else, because it's so unusual. In a way, Thelma and Louise has a happy, triumphant ending where the protagonists kill themselves. It's interesting. It's a tight wire act that you walk as a writer. And yet the reason that we watch the tight wire act, with bated breath, clutching our popcorn bags, clutching the genitals of our next-door neighbor as we watch the guy walk up there, or girl, walk up there. They could fall. And they could die if they fall. I'm not going to be as so pessimistic as to say that we secretly want them to fall. I don't think so. I think we want them to make it. But we also want to feel that they could. And, yeah, Bradbury ends this story on a really negative note. And I don't like it. But that's the power of the negative, of the unhappy ending, is that he went there. Oh, geez. And for the next story that I read by him, I'll have that in the back of my mind, as this is a guy that will go there. So our characters are not safe. There is a value in that.
Anyhow, I hope you have enjoyed the story anyway. I hope you liked the way that I performed it. Let me know in the comments if there are Ray Bradbury stories that you think I should run. I mean, he's a very high-profile writer, and so I shouldn't do his stories. But I recorded A Sound of Thunder last year, and I had meant to run that on the podcast, and I never did because the story was just too long. I think it was like a 90-minute recording. And I thought, geez, I don't want to edit that. But if there are favorites that you have, Bradbury favorites, let me know. And I will, I'll at least look them up, see if I can read them. I haven't read a lot of his stuff, and it would be cool to say that I had. All right. Well, thank you for joining me once again. Can't tell you the name of this podcast, but I can tell you to have a good night and to just let the phone ring.
The music in this episode was created by Kevin MacLeod, whose shenanigans can be found over at incompetech.com. Now, MacLeod, let's see what kind of swordsman you've become. The podcast that dares not speak its name is produced under a Creative Commons Attribution No Derivatives 3.0 license. You're damned right.
Police and fire brigade, police and fire brigade, or police and fire brigade, police and fire brigade arrived quickly.
Let's go back.
Right as the bus headed out of the lot, a boy sat down beside her. He said, which seemed like a very strange pickup line, but it worked on Lara. She was funny that way.
Okay, and so an author's note, she doesn't like that I said coup de grace and ate the lower half of his body while he was dying. They refused to give him a coup de grace and ate the lower half of his body while he was dying. They refused to give him a coup de grace. They refused to give him a coup de grace. She says I said grace wrong too. Shut up. How do you pronounce coup de grace?
And then to drive the global economy off a cliff was kind of the coup de grace, wasn't it? You can't.
It's coup de grace? Coup de grace. I don't know. She says Google will say it for you.
We are looking at how to say this French expression, how to pronounce this French expression that means the final blow or the final shot given to kill a wounded person or an animal. How do you go about pronouncing this in French with the typical French pronunciation as well as in English or American? Coup de grâce. Coup de grâce. In French, coup de grâce. Coup de grâce.
Okay. American, wait. Did you just say in English for American?
Coup de grâce. In French, coup de grâce. Coup de grâce. But in English or American, coup de grâce. Do not pronounce the P. Do not say coup, but rather coup de grâce. Coup de grâce.
Okay, pal. Thank you. Let's be friends.
They refuse to give him a coup de grace. This is extreme behavior, even for lions. This left Mr. T alone, pitying the fools that had ruined his day.
A lot of people call Ray the father of science fiction, don't they? I should ask my phone what they called Ray Bradbury. What nickname was given to Ray Bradbury? Apparently, Ray Bradbury's middle name was Douglas, named after Douglas Fairbanks. That was not what I wanted. Anyhow,